Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Be Good and Rewatch It. We are currently working our way through M. Night Shyamalan's... Man, there's a name for this trilogy. I had it written down. What was the train that was on in Unbreakable?
Oh, is that what it is? It's called named after that train?
I believe so.
Huh.
I can't remember.
The Unbreakable train. The Amtrak.
Something like that.
Anyway, the Amtrak trilogy?
The East Rail 177 trilogy.
There you go.
Heroes of the Acela universe.
We are here to talk about Split, the second in the three of those, the third one being Glass, which came out last weekend and made a whole lot of money. And actually, this one did too. Weirdly, Unbreakable made no money. Split made a lot of money. Glass made a lot of money. I am joined to talk about Split, that is the voice of Rob Zachney. Hello, Rob.
Hello, hello. My Acela hero power is to be utterly silent in the quiet car.
Natalie Watson, what's your power?
Where's my movie?
Ooh, my power is...
Slowly amassing Kingdom Hearts lore to prepare to spit it out at a later date.
Yes.
On a train next to...
In the quiet car, no less.
In the quiet
car. And so then what Goofy did was he just got the others to believe in themselves. And then Mickey, but it's not really Mickey. It's more like he's Jesus. Anyway, Mickey.
God.
And Austin Walker.
Free drinks. That is my power. I go to the bar, the person who comes around with drinks. I'm like, can I get a gin and tonic? And then they give it to me and they forget to ask me for money. It's good. It's
so
a
you're
good power.
Stealing?
Oh, so it's not. So you're able to just quietly cheat plate establishments out of money. It's not like they're gifting it to you. They're just forgetting to take the money.
I like to think of it as a gift.
Maybe they're like, I just forgot. Maybe.
No, they don't come back. They never come back for it, and no one knows.
And they send you a wink.
Austin Walker's superpower, okay, much like M. Night Shyamalan, will rationalize whatever's in front of them that makes them look the best.
Absolutely.
Split is a 2016 horror film from M. Night Shyamalan.
I thought you were going to say Split is a bad movie. And I was like, yep.
Split is a complicated movie.
Boy.
It's about the kidnapping of three young women by a man named Kevin, who's played by actor James McAvoy. He's a man with a dissociative identity disorder. We used to call that multiple personality disorder. Now we call it DID, dissociative identity disorder, causing him to have sort of 23 distinct identities. These identities have different names, personalities, vocal inflections. They share the same face as Kevin, and they're aware that other identities exist, but consider themselves to be distinct of their own. One is a 9-year-old boy, another is an older authoritarian woman, another is a clean of substance man with a preference for exceptionally young women. It sort of runs a spectrum. We get a window into a handful of them, but there are 23 identities sort of circling around in Kevin. Kevin's been working with a therapist for more than a decade, but this therapist theorizes these identities are just part of someone's psychology or identity, but also can cause physiological changes as well. One of the examples used in the film was that someone like the equivalent of Kevin, sort of the original, could be blind, but then have a identity that can see, and then the eye would develop sight because it believes that it can see. In the past, Kevin's identities have referred to a 24th identity, referred to as the Beast, but it's kind of seen as sort of like a myth, between the relationship of Kevin and his therapist, and sort of the central mystery of the film is whether the quote-unquote the Beast is going to finally arrive and what exactly that means. Split. Whew, okay. This is such an interesting movie to rewatch.
We should say up top that this is going to be like real. We're going to have discussion about mental illness and about abuse, and including implied sexual abuse.
Yeah, and sexual abuse to children.
To children, yeah, specifically. So like,
and self harm,
and also self harm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. All key things throughout this movie. So it's gonna be I'm not saying we're gonna go into it.
Yeah, well, it's just more sort of like know that heads for up. The whole conversation, as opposed to, I don't think it'll be the kind of thing where it's like, and now we're gonna have a discussion that like you can skip past. I think it's just going to it's going to be part of the holistic conversation of this movie. When I first saw this movie, it remains an effective movie in the way that M. Night Shyamalan is incredibly good at building tension. I think it's a movie that, in a lot of ways, works really well in the moment of making you all the things that M. Night has proven to be very good at in his career, when he wants to scare you and make you tense and make you flinch. But especially upon a rewatch, where you lose a lot of the dramatic tension of a horror film because you know what's coming. And so upon second viewing, a lot of it is doing a second reading, and the way the second readings are always very informative is that you lose the element of surprise, and then you're suddenly able to look at the work in a much wider manner. And the movie just, even if individual parts, remains sort of like really well filmed in a way that Shyamalan just has a knack for. It's a movie whose themes just do not come together at all, and it just completely leverages like a real life disorder in a really irresponsible way that like makes it, at least was for me, impossible to really enjoy on a second watch once you're like fully aware of what it was or wasn't trying to say by the end.
Yeah, you know, so this is my first time through it, obviously.
Is this everyone else's first time? Same. Am I the only one that's actually doing the Be Good and Rewatch?
The actual rewatch? Yeah totally. Unbreakable I saw, right? That's something. But for you, it's, yeah, this is definitely
what is rewatch. I like, specifically with the horror genre, there is something very specific about the rewatch aspect. Yeah. So I just wanted to make it clear with everyone that like this is a first rewatch for some people, or first watch for some people, and a rewatch for me, just because of the specific way that horror manipulates your own personal psychology.
Totally.
It's just interesting how that plays out on a second viewing.
I will say that like, there are things that I can say were well done in terms of like location design and stuff like that, and like even some shots, but like I just had a bad time watching this movie all the way through, largely because a lot of the things that I think we'll talk about today kept me from ever sinking into my seat and letting the film work on me. I was so hyper aware of the ways in which Shyamalan was using abuse and mental illness as fulcrum points for where that tension was supposed to be coming from, that I could never quite find in a full audience position.
How much of that is because you were aware of the discussion around Split, or how much is of that because as watching Split, you were putting on Critic Hat and...
Right, because there's a
difference in
like
watching
this.
The way you process a piece of media, especially for us as critics. Like,
yeah,
you can watch a movie as a.
I mean, here's what I'll say: is I think the dialogue is bad. Also, okay. I think the dialogue is bad. It's like I've written down so many lines here where they're just things like, there's a bit very early on where someone says like, "It is the therapist talking to Barry," which is the alter who is a fashion designer. Mm-hmm. And she says, "This is just the sort of thing Hamptons ladies would spend $15,000 on, which is not the way a person speaks." And so immediately, even from a craft level, I just wasn't in it. And I'll say to Patrick, like, this is just how I watch stuff. Like, I don't have a different viewing perspective most of the time, unless it's like 2 a.m. and I have Netflix on and I'm like falling asleep. But like,
I was just saying, like, I do. Like, I very much.
Right.
Because
which is fine. I want to be clear. Like, I have that for music, for instance. Like, there's plenty of songs that I listen to where I'm not deconstructing the work. But like in film, in games, in literature, I have that. That is just my natural.
Yeah. Usually with stuff I just want to enjoy for myself, I just turn that off. And
yeah.
So I just want to kind of establish where people were coming from in terms of like how they view this film, or just generally how they view films in general. So anyway, Natalie, Rob, what about the two of you?
Yeah, this is also my first time watching it. I knew vaguely, I mean, I knew that it was about someone with DID. So that was kind of like my context for going into it. I will say that I was tense throughout the movie, but mostly because I was like concerned. Like, I was just like, frustrated and like worried about where the film was going to go and like worried about what was going to happen in a way that I wasn't like I was worried about what it meant. Not like I'm worried about like the fate of these girls. I was like, I'm worried about like the fact that this exists. Like I'm worried about the fact of like where the movie goes, the fact that this will exist in the world. So yeah, it was like immediately I thought, you know, one thing that I thought was cool, I guess, is, you know, the idea that you're not really sure where everything's taking place, and then you kind of walk through the Philadelphia Zoo in the end segment. Like that was
like, oh yeah, I actually like that a lot. That moment is really strong.
Yeah, that moment was really strong for me. Just like, because the whole time I'm like, where the fuck is this taking place? Like, this is such an obscure, like anonymous, like area, the underground. And then seeing like the girl walk through the like cages and stuff like that was like very poignant for me. But it was such a hard watch for me. It was just, yeah, it was rough.
Yeah, my feeling about a lot of this movie is that it was a, in many cases, well-crafted bit of filmmaking, with the exception of the writing. Like, I think it's a weak script, but like, again, I think Shyamalan can direct a film effectively. I think that effect is used to almost like immoral ends in this case. Like, I think this movie, it troubles me on levels that go beyond filmmaking. It is exploitative in a way that, yes, that is maybe sometimes part and parcel of horror films, but I think this movie is very much trying to have it both ways, with trying to be very serious about the film it's making, but then it is so heightened, and then it is also adopting wholeheartedly and embracing tropes of exploitation and kind of a leering male gaze, that the film ends up really intensely turning me off in several places.
I mean, like, this movie didn't have to use a real life disorder.
Yes,
right.
Yes, that's huge.
And in reading, I'll end up linking some of these out to people, and I've linked some of these essays for our own reading. But like in reading, like, responses from folks with DID or folks who have dealt with other forms of mental illness, you know, one of the things that they struggle with in their own reactions to the film is, well, on one hand, the movie gets a lot right about the origins of DID, right? In which a lot of folks that have DID did have childhood trauma, often sexual childhood trauma, that leads to the brain having a defense mechanism of what ends up the resulting being a DID. And this film, like, accurately to the reactions of folks that I've read, like, portrays that. But then what it does with that is monstrous. And there's a world where if this, by naming it DID and then also IDing the origins of DID for folks who actually are dealing with that in real life, and then to lead to the conclusion that this movie draws for you, like, by drawing from real life, like, you then have to deal with the consequences and the responsibilities of that, and the movie just doesn't seem interested. It's interested in co-opting something from the headlines without, like, let me just, I'm going to read this quote from M. Night. There were a lot of things written about the film afterwards, but not a lot of actual discussion with the filmmaker sort of ahead of time. But at Nerdist, unfortunately, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Christy Puchko, who actually I follow on Twitter. She's a really, really interesting film critic who is constantly, through her work, she is the one that is like, but hey, like, putting up the finger in a way that reminds a lot of the work that we do here at Waypoint. And so she's a really good follow if you're looking for folks that are looking at often big blockbuster films that aren't always getting that critical eye. And she was on the film or the press circuit for this movie and asked M. Night about it. And her first question was, what's your response to the criticism of this movie? I'm paraphrasing her question. And he says, slightly off guard, I'm sure it's exhausting to do these press tours, but the fact that he didn't have a well-prepared statement is illustrative of probably other problems.
Priorities
in the script.
And yeah, totally.
So Shyamalan says, first of all, there has been almost none criticism. It's been a little bit, and I totally understand that. But when you see the movie, there's really kind of a benevolent approach to this disorder, really kind of a talking point. People don't even know about the disorder, and it's a wonderful talking point on it. It obviously goes into fiction and totally somewhere else by the end of the movie, somewhere far off, but I've always been interested in disorders, psychology. Since I was in
college.
Why
does it feel like Donald Trump wrote this?
Wow.
It feels like...
Let me finish.
Okay, sorry.
That wasn't the end. Okay.
Okay.
Since I was in college, my awkward pauses are his awkward pauses.
Yeah,
I'm trying to...
Yeah.
Since I was in college, I've been very interested in this particular disorder, which more and more information has come out over the years. Incredibly poignant and moving. I would love more people to know about it because I don't think a lot of people get diagnosed properly with the disorder. And in fact, I don't think the psychological field supports it in the way it should be supported. It's seen as this controversial or getting a lot of light but not accurate kind of thing. I personally believe in it 100%. I'm a big proponent in these individuals being treated properly. And then she also asks, what is your responsibility to using a real life disorder? Which is a very poignant, spot on question that you don't normally get an actual answer to.
Yeah.
And he says that the facts are correct. For me, it's to make sure it's complicated in its portrayal, that there's good, bad, that there's light. I don't know. The light is not an actual... Anyway, for me, it's a positive portrayal at the end of the day. Cough. James brought such humanity to the part. Both of us had known about the disorder. Even when I hired him, he was very much aware of the disorder. I think like in a lot of ways, helps explain a lot of the film, in which you have someone that did the Wikipedia research, which is like...
It was an intro to psych class.
Yeah, like figured out like, oh, childhood disorder, often sexual in nature, split identities, and hits those bullet points and even gets in the bullshit. But while I want them to be treated properly, they're probably not getting diagnosed properly. True. That is 100%.
Well, that's why Split is such a powerful diagnostic tool. If you match any of the 23 or 24 personalities exhibited in this film, and if your body chemistry changes, you may indeed have DID.
Working title 23 in me. So that perspective is in this movie in the character of the therapist, right? Whose whole thing is like, I'm trying to bring attention to this thing. And the most frustrating thing, and I think we should lay out why we think it is, like, you know, Rob, you said, immoral at points, right? Like, I think it's easy to be like, this portrayal is bad. And for listeners, maybe to not understand why we think, why we go from it's an inaccurate portrayal to a harmful one. Mm-hmm. And so the two big points that I want to hit that I think there's a bunch of points to hit in general, but like two of the big ones for me, and I think that these are backed up by some of the pieces you linked to us, Patrick, in the prep for this. One is that people who have DID harm themselves. They don't harm other people. This is the most terrifying thing about being diagnosed or knowing that there is something wrong with your brain is that you have to go tell somebody that. And in a world that thinks that you are a harmful, dangerous person, that is a very, very scary thing to do. And it leads lots of people and has historically led lots of people, not just with DID, but with mental illness in general, with a lot of different conditions, to be afraid to go tell someone that because of the stigmatization around it.
So there's an essay from The Mighty, which is a sort of community where people can self-submit essays about their own experiences with mental health. And someone who has DID wrote, one part of the film that really upset me was when the therapist was killed. DID is recognized by professionals, but there's no denying resources and just basic training severely lacking in most parts of the world. Even within the medical community, people are divided about the validity of DID. Who's going to want to try and work with these, quote, scary DID systems?
Right.
To say films like Split are, quote, just a movie or saying, quote, don't hurt anyone, couldn't be further from the truth. Upon my using myself as an example again, I was admitted to one psychiatric ward where the psychiatrist immediately picked up on our DID diagnosis and said DID doesn't exist. He told me I was, quote, clearly disturbed and lying for attention because I didn't get enough as a child. He literally said that DID is, quote, the stuff of Hollywood movies.
Right. And so,
which, like, goes all the way back to Psycho, right? Psycho absolutely. Is sort of like the original, and before that, it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I believe is sort of seen as like the originator of like fiction co-opting the first understandings of what would eventually become DID.
Right. The second part of this ends up being less about DID for me and more about the portrayal of abuse and victims and what good victimship looks like. So much of this movie is interested in what you should do if you are under threat or being abused or being held captive. And it models good victimhood by modeling the ways in which kind of defensive victimhood leads to worse outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
The girls who try to get away are punished for it and end up dead. And lose their clothes. And the camera fucking loves it.
Consistently in this film.
It's like,
don't worry.
It's the fucking grossest
These young 22-year-olds
like,
are going to lose their shirts at one point or another.
Constantly. 22-year-olds playing 17 or 18-year-olds, right? Like, as much as the plot can say, oh, these women are losing their clothes because this character wants it, the way it's shot is very interested in showing girls half-dressed all the way through the movie. And of course, it ends up being tied to the big reveal at the end, which is the lead, Chloe, is that – no, not Chloe. What is the character's name? Maybe it's Chloe. I have it written down somewhere. Casey, is that she self-harms and self-mutilates and, like, cuts her body and scars herself as a coping mechanism. And that marks her as being what the Beast understands as being a good person.
Because
she's
broken.
Been through shit. Which,
because she's specifically
because she's
broken.
Quote unquote broken. Which, self harm is not the only a sign of abuse. Those other two girls could absolutely have gone through abuse. Abuse is not something that there is no physical outward facing sign that is a single way to mark a history of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like super important to understand, especially as we go through the world in the middle of the Me Too movement, that like there is no single fucking like proof that someone has gone through abuse, sexual or otherwise. And then two, like, there is something at the fucking root of this movie and Unbreakable that I cannot unpack, that I'm trying to unpack. And I guess we're going to see Glass and maybe that'll help me with this. But in Glass, we talked about in Unbreakable, we talked about the strange relationship between Mr. Glass and Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, as like one of them is invincible and is like this middle class or like working class schlub. The other is this like person who has been through lots of trauma, whose entire life was trauma, and who wants the world to recognize some deep, deep truth about the world that they're ignoring. This is a very similar motivation for the Beast, right? When the Beast is finally revealed, his entire motivation is like the only people who understand the truth are those who've been wounded or those who've been harmed. And look at how powerful we, the people who have been harmed, really are. And there is an ideology here at play that I can't quite – that I don't know that M. Night Shyamalan understands. Like, I don't think this is necessarily even a developed position. Mm-hmm. But there is a through line between these movies in which marginalized identities, abused identities –
it's about suffering your, like, place in the world, your identity.
Yes.
And
they want to show
and being,
that they're
being fundamentally broken in some way that somehow you warp to your – or use to your advantage. Like –
Right.
You
use it to
your
advantage.
You can't start putting things on a pin board and being like, I don't see the A to B to C, but it is all connected.
How close are we to the race card? Do you know what I mean? Like, how close are we to weaponized identities? And there's even some of that in the therapist character who in her weird Skype talk is like, what if we could unlock the brain by way of...
Yeah, no. It's like, it's seen as like something metahuman, like something, you know, that like... aside from just being othered, like put on a pedestal of like the human's capability to change itself. And I'll just say, like, right now I saw Glass this past weekend and it gets worse with Glass. Like that, like, I won't spoil anything and we will talk about it next week.
Is it as much of a focus in Glass or is there other shit for me to like latch onto? And
there's other shit. There's other shit.
Okay.
There's other shit.
Okay. We'll talk about Glass next time.
Yeah, this is like this whole through line is what fucked me up so much throughout this movie, is that like seeing this girl, you know, the flashbacks to her childhood of like childhood abuse by her uncle, which then she like goes and lives with after her father passes away. And the fact that oh my God. The fact that at the end of the movie, when she's seen by the beast and he sees like her scars, he like spares her or whatever and is like, oh, you have potential. Like, you are also broken. You have potential. And then she goes and like gets away from her uncle. Like, she like goes, the last scene is like, well, not the last scene, but it's like her in a police car and the police officer comes over to her, is like, your uncle is here. And she like doesn't move. And then there's like a small, like subtle kind of like understanding.
See, I think that there's a will she won't she there.
That's, yeah, I think it's left kind of open.
Which is the worst.
Oh, okay.
I think the cop starting to, like, there's a look that passes between her and the cop.
I thought the cop was, like, kind of, yeah, I thought the cop, like, kind of got it.
But I want that confirmation given the stakes. I wanted that confirmation so badly. I just wanted her to be like, I'm going to stay here, actually, or whatever.
Yeah, but why is it that, like, she had to fucking go through a whole nother round of,
absolutely,
like,
garbage.
Trauma and then be, like, have this, like, weird, like, allyship with her abuser, like,
right.
This, like,
yes.
like victimhood, shared victimhood together. And then, and also, like, I think that one of these articles that you passed along to us, Patrick, the one from The Verge, talks about, you know, the fact that we don't see Kevin enough. And that, like, we are, it is, like, so focused on everyone else that we don't get to see, like, Kevin.
Yeah.
Like,
there's one moment.
Like, he shows
Kevin
up
is,
once.
Kevin is mentioned. His full name is used as a safe word of sorts that the therapist says, it's like a cheat code, basically, where it's like, if you say his full name, then Kevin's personality,
like,
comes all the way forward, regardless of the identity or personality that is currently in the light, the one that gets to project through Kevin's body. And it's, mm-hmm. yeah, like, they're, like, probably one of the most powerful scenes in the movie, like, is the brief moment you get with Kevin, where you get an insight into, like, a very, what could have been such a different movie, in which, like, splits the movie with, like, where it's playing with pieces, that there is probably a world where you could have constructed something that was playing in a similar sandbox, but found a very different outcome. But the one moment you get with Kevin where, like, you know, you have that powerful moment where he, you know, he's asked what day it is, and I don't know what year it is in Split.
He thinks it's 2014.
September 2014, he was on a bus.
It's like 2016 or something.
Yeah, so it's been, like, years since he has actually,
like,
you know,
been in the light.
Been in the light, and, like, you can imagine a film that put Kevin at the center of it, and, like, what does Kevin think of all this? Like, and none of that is there, and, like, that's where, I mean, this movie is exploitative for all sorts of reasons, but, like, the first, especially the way it takes it into a villainous turn. But even absent that, the lack of making Kevin a character, he's just an empty vessel for a bunch of cute little side characters that Shyamalan came up with and shoved into
Kevin
the understandably brilliant acting of James McAvoy. He's part of the reason this movie is able to pull a trick on you, is because it is almost impossible to not be blinded by McAvoy's, like, tremendous acting. And it's what blinds you often to, my guess is, you know, especially on my first viewing, and I think for lots of people who watch this movie, like, they get blinded by the shiny thing in front of them, which is, you know, McAvoy switching personalities, you know, willy-nilly, and doing so very effectively.
I think the Kevin performance is really strong. Like, that moment is actually very, like, one of the few that really shook me out of it. And I also wonder what a film that was less focused on the set of characters who are called the Horde, which are the Patricia, Dennis,
anyone who, like,
Hedwig,
aligned
right
with the beast, yeah,
with any, yeah, the group,
because there are others,
the,
it's like two factions,
right? Well, it's like it's 20 characters, it's 20, mm-hmm. it's 20 alters, and then the three that are aligned with the beast.
Mm-hmm.
And we get, of those other 20, we get Barry a little bit, or mostly we get Dennis pretending to be Barry.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a few video clips of three or four of the others,
yeah,
I don't know that I want the movie where it's like James McAvoy,
each one.
Yeah, doing each one in a comic styling, like rapidly switching between them. That would also probably be bad. But the version that gives that gives room for Kevin's other alters to appear and be seen as people, and also a version that is interested in whatever that abuse is and Kevin's humanity, would also be useful, because instead what we get, the abuse narrative that we get I just looked up her name and I've already forgotten it.
Casey.
I keep wanting to say Chloe for some. Maybe one of the other girls named Chloe. Casey's abuse slowly rolled out to us in just like the most intense, like bit by bit. Here it comes. Is this going to be the terrible scene? Where is it? Like, and it, like, just cut half of those and give me a little bit of who Kevin has been in his life, and I would be in a much better place, I think, with the movie.
Because it also doesn't even land her story, right? Like, I mean, that's also what, like, makes the movie so deeply frustrating, is because the character that it does put the camera's focus on, the script's focus on, it doesn't serve her interest particularly well either. So it's like the movie did it at the service of a character who probably shouldn't have been the central character by ignoring the one that probably should have been. And doesn't, you know, doesn't faithfully land that character's own personal narrative. Yeah.
I have to run to a meeting.
So we're going to take a break. We're going to let Austin go. We'll come
in. No big final thoughts other than what I've already said. I guess my big final thought is that, like, it is okay for a movie like this to not work for you. Like, it is. I think it can be easy for us to sometimes. There are times when I beat myself up where I'm like, why can't I just have fun with this? Mm-hmm. But I want to be the person who was like, it's all right. Like, there are things that I let myself have fun with. Those things happen to be giant robots. And, you know, stories about war are also fucked up. And I'm here for that. I'm here to be dragged for that. But if you were like me, someone who can, like, watch a movie like this and be like, I just can't find it. That is, I can't find the audience position. That is an okay thing to have.
All right. Well, we'll take a break. Let Austin go. And we'll come back and finish up our discussion of Split.
Bye-bye.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we're back. I do want to read a quote. Natalie, you had mentioned this piece from The Verge. It was a piece written by Charles Bromesco. And I'll name the titles and authors at the end so we can make sure we plug all the bits that I've been pulling from. But in his piece, it was called Split is the Latest Horror Film to Misunderstand Why Mental Illness is Terrifying. I think sort of like the relevant bit to sort of our discussion of Kevin there was... mental illness does have its place in the horror genre, and it is scary. The feeling that your brain no longer follows the commands you give it, that your senses can't be trusted, that you're at the mercy of internal forces you can't comprehend or control, it can be a nightmare sprung to life. It's a filmmaker's responsibility to keep it all in perspective and extend a grain of sympathy to affected characters, even as they slide further into their delusion. And I think this upcoming line is like really key to understanding like other films that have done this both effectively and not effectively in the same movie. Mm-hmm. Charles writes, the world remembers Hannibal Lecter and his refinement coexisting with savagery, not Buffalo Bill, whose body dysmorphia transforms him into a snarling feral animal. One is a character, the other's a ghoul. It's possible that Shyamalan realizes this too. When Kevin briefly appears, he's a friendly figure compared to his alternative personalities. But Shyamalan's creaky dialogue and McAvoy's detached stoicism in the moment make that moment ring false, more lip service than a character beat. The real Kevin seems to be a relatively normal guy, only faintly affected by his own psychosis. In that moment, all the tension and internal conflict evaporates, and any connection the audience may have had with him is instantly severed. That moment encapsulates the trouble with Split and with the countless films that have made the same error. Before we can feel her pain, we've got to feel his. And I think that bit like neatly summarizes like so much of what the horror genre gets wrong about mental illness. You know, it's like so many things. It's not that it's off the table. It's just that when you invoke it, especially now when we know so much, you know, there's no excuse anymore. I mean, you know, I can't claim to know the broad understanding of mental illness when Hitchcock directed Psycho, but it was a lot different than 2016 or 2015 when this was filmed. We knew enough to not make these kinds of mistakes. Like when you're making these mistakes, it's not out of ignorance that then looks silly upon a broader understanding of mental health. It's ignorance because you've already decided what the end point is and you're just looking to figure out things along the way. I think we've like kind of Rob, I feel like maybe you've floated this as a theory of how Shyamalan often seems to work, which is that he figures out where he wants to be, and then how he gets there is sort of the part that he fumbles his way through.
Yeah. I think he tends to, and particularly with this movie, in the end, it feels like where he wants to be is a really forced reaching tie-in to a previous work, which is why this is kind of a movie without a real twist. The twist is that it's a sequel. Mm-hmm. But as far as what the arc of this movie is, it's not really well thought out. It begins from a premise, and its endpoint is franchise. And the narrative, you know, the narrative arc isn't very well considered, and it's why I think it ends up being gross in so many different places. But I have to be honest, like, for me, it's less the mental illness stuff that bothers me with this film, because the mental illness stuff is so patently ridiculous, it is so heightened, that to a degree, I feel like it buys itself a little bit of a hand-wavy excuse by being so obviously full of shit about this disorder.
And that, actually, a different essay point made that exact point with someone who was, you know, with mental illness, was like, look, yeah, it's bad, but like any reasonable person is going to look at this and go, oh, it's just a, you know, it's just a movie being ridiculous. This isn't actually what these...
One of his personalities can shrug off a shotgun blast because it's just so twisted. But I think the other where I think that does get really complicating, though, is the fact that I think we are supposed to identify and sympathize with the therapist, and she is a charlatan. Like, I think we're supposed to think she's good, and she knows what she's doing, but she is kind of patently spouting absolute hocus pocus about this disorder. And as Austin alluded to earlier, maybe this disorder is the way to unlock the full potential of the human brain. She is a few months away from selling like direct mail videos about unlocking your inner personalities with like fucking testimonials from Kevin. Like that is the character, but I think the movie wants us to sympathize. I think the movie wants to react to her almost in the way we react to the Bruce Willis character in The Sixth Sense as what a conscientious healer.
Well, because there's the is everything okay, Natalie?
Yeah, she didn't want spoilers.
Yet. Oh. Sorry, you had a reaction that sounded like a loud noise just went through your headphones. Rob, there's that scene which I think is like clearly written. It's like a very throwaway scene where the therapist is talking with a friend. They're walking, like, mm-hmm. watching like the Shopping Network, and the friend says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, something along the lines like, how do you deal with those people? And she says, like, well, no, like, they are people, you know, like she does like the checkpointy, the bullet listy thing that sort of like Shyamalan does in his public facing comments of like, oh no, I'm recognizing that these are people, they are to be respected and understood, and it's more, it's not just that, you know, they're quote unquote crazy, like, you know, that's what that neighbor or friend is supposed to represent, and then that exchange is supposed to get her off the hook for all the other things that she's irresponsibly perpetuating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it would be fine, like I liked her in the beginning because she had such a genuine, you know, like, I don't know, just like the there was, you know, something very real about the way that she like talked to Barry and stuff like that. And like, you know, that was the fact that she's like taking everything seriously and is like being helpful and that, you know,
not judgmental. Barry, she's talking to them like they're people.
Yeah, exactly. It's just all thrown away when you hear the Skype conversation, because she's, you know, yeah, whenever you hear unlock the fucking phrase, unlock the full human potential, just like like leave.
I feel like Joe Rogan is trying to sell me some fucking vitamins to fund his podcast.
There's a secret only known threat to the most powerful people in history.
Alpha brain.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want a have you seen that meme, Galaxy Brain? You want that Galaxy Brain? buy my fucking protein shake.
And this is where I think it really does get messy, is the reason her colleagues are treating her with skepticism isn't because they just don't understand the disorder. It kind of sounds like they do. It sounds like they understand the clinical reality of DID, and what she is saying is the superhero nonsense this movie is peddling. But this is where it gets really muddled and confused. She's giving this like talk to this like psychology conference in France over Skype, which I guess I think is still kind of implying that she's kind of fringe, so she's not really...
Yeah, I didn't understand.
You didn't get invited. Like, yeah, they didn't pay for your travel.
They were like, okay, you're going to have your own panel. And then they were like... And then there was another conversation where, like, actually, you're going to be on someone else's. And then she just was on the Skype call, which, like, that through line just made no fucking sense to me. I was like, wait, so are you being like, I don't understand. Is this the panel? Like, it just made no sense.
Right. And they treat her with skepticism because she's claiming, oh, yeah, one of the personalities is diabetic and the others aren't. Just completely different physiological, you know, symptoms and realities for these different personalities. They're completely different people. And the skepticism of the colleagues is, is that how we understand this disorder to work? Because it doesn't sound like it. And that's where it gets muddled. She is at once the voice of compassion and understanding for people with DID, but at the same time, she's also the person saying magic is real. And then you have, as a foil for her, more like you have psychologists who inhabit the real world that behaves according to actual like clinical rules and procedures, and they are set up as the people who don't get it. They are set up as the people who are wrong. And I think that's where it gets really muddled with this. But at a certain point, I am comfortable to start throwing up my hands and saying, look, this was a device to let McAvoy throw this movie on his shoulders and just chew scenery from beginning to end to get us through it. Where the movie loses me from the beginning is all its gender politics, all its portrayals and depictions and attitudes towards sexual violence, and the way that value and worth is assigned to the trio of young women who are abducted in this film really bothered me. And it starts going wrong fast. Like, it's not that the movie comes to a bad ending with that stuff, but pretty much it's off.
Did you guys watch the alternate ending?
No. What's the alternate ending?
There's a 20-second alternate ending that M. Night, the version that I watched had like a tiny little interview with M. Night at the beginning where he says, you know, I had this alternate ending and I just like this is the original one and I just didn't know where to put it. And then it just didn't fit. So I took it out, but I still want to show it to you. So it's at the end of the movie. And then the alternate ending goes, it's McAvoy as I think as Hedwig. I'm not sure, I don't remember which altar it was, but it's McAvoy sitting on like a rooftop on like one side of the street, and across the street is like an all-girls school, and he's just staring at them, and he was like, look, I forget what he calls them, like, look at all the impure, what is he, he's like the like impure,
he does use the term impure like at a different point in the movie or something.
He calls like specifically the girls that he like wants for sacrifice, which are like meant to fuel the beast or some shit.
None of that logic is laid out.
It makes no fucking sense.
All. Like, yeah, it's even if you're to like brush aside like the hyperbole of the film for dramatic purposes, like it doesn't follow like an internal logic that makes you go, all right, well that's bullshit, but it makes sense by the movie's own terms.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The movie doesn't like properly establish like what is the why did the beast need these three women? If it was because the three of them are like had been identified as broken, right? Like
no, like, it's the broken.
It's like
ones.
He happens to find out that the Claire is
Casey.
Is Casey. Claire? Chloe.
Chloe, Claire.
Casey.
Casey.
That, like, he finds that out by accident at the end. So then what the fuck was he doing with these women in the first place? It's like, is it just that it's like young virginal sacrifice? That means their blood and meat is, like, better? That's not even spelled out in the movie, right? Like, that's, he doesn't even, like, lay out that, like, that's the perverted. And plus, the beast isn't even the one with the perverted sexual fetish. Like, that's.
That's Dennis.
Dennis, right?
Dennis likes to watch girls dance naked. I think it was, and I could be wrong, but I think it was that they're impure and unbroken. So they are, like, impure in some sense and also have not been, like, broken or whatever. So he's sitting on this fucking rooftop. It's like a 15-second scene, which is just like, okay, fuck off. But he's sitting there and he's like, look at all these, like, impure, unbroken, you know, girls, like the potential, or like something along the lines of like, look at all this like material that we can use to make ourselves stronger, and that's the end, that's it. And it's like, what is the fucking purpose? Like, what, like, knowing that like that was M. Night Shyamalan's like original ending to the movie, and like that's like what he wanted, that's like where he wanted that McAvoy to end on, is like this like new journey of like, and God, we'll talk about Glass in a week, but
you really want to talk about Glass.
It's so fucked, dude. It gets so much worse. It gets so much worse. Like, you have no idea how much worse it gets. It gets so much worse. And yeah, I just, the feeling that when it comes down to, I just, it's like fucking irresponsible. Like, this just feels like a half-assed, like, not thought out, being like, okay, I'm gonna rely on McAvoy's like acting abilities, like acting chops, to just like deliver that these characters well. And yeah, and what you said, Rob, about like starting with like a premise and an ending and then just filling in, it just feels like it just feels so fucking messy and unclear, and then irresponsible. Like, the literal plot and logic is unclear and messy, and then the premise and what it's doing and what it's saying is fucking irresponsible, and that's just so frustrating.
And it starts to go wrong from the start. Like, so, like, I think my understanding of this is that some of the personalities are performing basically a summoning ritual to bring the beast about, which is why you have a scene with them getting the flowers and going to the train yard where the beast supposedly lives because of childhood trauma. Who the hell knows? But the entire thing is about bringing the beast, which is why you have... oh gosh, whatever the sort of evil Mary Poppins personality, you know,
Miss Patricia.
Yeah, Miss Patricia, which is why you have her talking about you are sacred food. But where it starts to go wrong for me is right after the girls are abducted, they wake up in this underground prison, basically. Mm-hmm. And the threat of sexual violence is, like, probably at its greatest height, like, right in the scene, because they literally have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. And they are talking about what they should do when he comes in the next time. You know, should they jump him? Should they fight? They need to fight back. And where this... But that is preceded by one of the women... say, basically blaming herself for even getting abducted in the first place. We were such victims. We didn't do anything. We were, we just sort of sat there because, and I don't remember what the justification was in that scene, but it was this sort of self-blaming attitude, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing to voice in this film, to show a character having that feeling of recrimination. But where it gets weird for me is that I think we're supposed to, like, sort of identify with Casey as she's both the point of view character, but also she's kind of the smart one, right? Like, she's the character who is going to get us out of this, and she's going to figure this out. And what she tells the girls is basically like, shut the hell up. We're not going to do shit until we have a plan. If we don't have a plan, it's not worth trying to do anything. So... You guys are dummies. we're gonna wait and we're gonna pause and we're going to figure this stuff out. And the other girls don't want to go with that, and they keep trying to make these like really desperate escape attempts, and each time they're punished.
Well, this character, you know, Casey is also one of the other magic tricks of the film, in the same way that McAvoy's acting is like the actress, Anya Taylor-Joy, who is also tremendous in a horror film called The Witch from a couple, like 3 or 4 years back, which is how she got into this film. Shyamalan saw her in that. She's just really good at being understated. She's a very empowering presence despite how young she looks. And she's hypnotizing in the same way that McAvoy can be. And like, that is what like this movie hangs itself on, are like very close, tight shots of both of these characters in which you end up believing, you know, I mean, or just awestruck by them because they become compelling through sheer acting. And it often is used as a way of allowing you to kind of like not pay so much attention to like, does this make sense? Is this logical? Is this going somewhere? But you're just compelled by the sheer acting ability of like both of these presences in the film, which is why often when either of them are talking, it's a very tight shot on both of their faces. Like, this movie, more than any other Shyamalan film, especially relative to Unbreakable, is very much about the camera being as close as possible to the characters, especially these two.
Is this something else that's going wrong with this movie a little bit? Is that there's just too much shit in it? Like, I think those scenes do tend to be some of the strongest in the film, where Casey and Kevin's different personalities, where Casey's trying to figure out who she's dealing with, what the leverage points are, how to handle them. Those scenes tend to be effective. It's such a weird scene, but there's so much suspense in it when she convinces the most childlike of the personalities, Hedwig to take her to his room and show her his special toy, which turns out to be a radio and a lifeline to the outside world. But it's such a weird scene. It's intense. And those scenes tend to work. But the movie I kept comparing this to is 10 Cloverfield Lane. Mm-hmm. But 10 Cloverfield Lane knows exactly what it's about. 10 Cloverfield Lane is pared down. It is about basically three characters, eventually like two characters, all trying to figure, like the protagonist in that film, I forget her name, is trying to figure out what she's dealing with and how she can, what she can trust and how she can safely make her escape without alerting her possible captor to the fact that she's gotten wise to the danger he poses.
Both movies are unreliable like characters, and it's like how do you find leverage with an unreliable character? But that movie keeps its focus on that. The movie is only that, and it attempts a similar thing to Split, which is like, oh, we're gonna, you know, it's going to be sort of like a bottle episode of a television show, where it's like, it's going to be more or less one location. And we're going to confine that so that the conceit being, oh, it's about the characters. But like, Split just loses that constantly in favor of world building, what eventually goes to franchise building, and also just losing what these characters are or could be. Because I didn't even think of it, but yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane is like, if you want to see a version of what Split is going for, it has nothing to do with, you know, a DAD or anything like that. But like, in terms of like cinematic genre, like Cloverfield Lane is like the much better version of that.
Right. Cause it's not detouring out to these. Every time we have those therapy scenes, nothing ever happens in them. It's yet another scene where James McAvoy chews some scenery. The therapist gets the sense that something is going on, but doesn't put the pieces together. I think there's at least two, there might be three separate scenes where that dynamic plays out. And then we go back to the torture dungeon, and we resume sort of that tense dynamic. And then the other problem is, because the focus is already diluted, the other two girls in the film, and I literally can't remember the characters' names, but the other two women are basically relegated to the role of spares in the film.
According to IMDb, so one of them The blonde girl is Claire Benoit, and Jessica, or that's the actress name, sorry, Marcia, the black girl, doesn't even get a last name in the script.
And the thing
so, like, that tells you a lot about where those characters are valued in this, is like, the white girl gets a last name. Eh, not her.
Well, and the other weird thing is, the movie does seem to have this idea of, I don't know, this weird judgment about what you're supposed to do when you're victimized, what you should do. But it also doesn't actually seem to have any kind of, like, notion about what it means for the answer to be, or how you should process that. Like, let's see. The two other girls make several pretty courageous attempts to bust out and are basically, like, fighting till the end to escape this nightmare. Doesn't matter. One of them is still killed in this really implicitly gory psychosexual cannibalism scene that is gross as hell, both, you know, kind of, it's kind of queasy, but also just thematically, it's gross as hell. But
she's also the only one that loses her pants, right?
I think they all lose their pants. I think everybody's...
Marcia doesn't have pants on. I thought it was Marcia doesn't have pants on, and then...
Everyone loses their top.
The other one loses the top. Yeah.
But even Casey loses her top by the end of the film.
Yeah.
But when she's Hedwig is like, you have so many. Is there? There's a point where Hedwig's like, you have so many shirts. Like Dennis says that you have the most shirts, and I guess she's like lost a sweater and then like an overshirt, and then now she's like down to her undershirt, which is fuck off. Oh God.
Well,
I don't know.
So. But then the other thing that Casey is haunted by, I guess, is the sense that she didn't react well as a little girl to when she was assaulted by her uncle. And there's a scene we revisit, and the uncle is played by Brad William Henke, who, if you're a Sports Night fan, played the creep on Sports Night, Christian Patrick. The star football player who attacks the intrepid reporter, Natalie. And this dude has made a career actor of being kind of a sinister meathead, is the role he plays. He's the uncle here.
Everyone's got to find their place.
Yeah. He's the outwardly friendly seeming, charismatic big dude who secretly is a rotten piece of shit. That's a character he plays a lot. Anyway... I think he might have also been Cush in Jerry Maguire. But anyway, so at one point, young Casey has this guy at shotgun point after he's attacked her, I think, for the first time. And she doesn't know what to do. And she has a chance to...
She's, like, ready to pull. And she's just, like...
Yeah, she hesitates
and gets
her
finger's on the trigger. She's not like, and she like knows what the fuck she's doing because like her dad and her uncle have taken her hunting, presumably like since forever.
Yeah. And she seems to like, she's traumatized by that, but she revisits that moment of not killing this guy, you know, as a little girl, basically when she had the chance. And later her father passes away and she's kind of entrusted to this predator's care. But that's one of the issues this film is working through. And it, implied there is the sense that Casey feels like she did something wrong. This is all somehow her fault. I don't know. There's just so many places where either openly the script is sort of musing about what you're supposed to do, what you should do in a situation like this, or the implied meaning of scenes is revisiting this question of blame and culpability in one's own assault and victimization. And the movie is so fixated on that, but also so muddled in what its meanings are, that's where the movie really started to piss me off. Because it's playing, this is heavy stuff. And Shyamalan is just kind of trying to juggle all these themes and doing it badly and treating it very casually. And that's probably what grossed me out the most.
Yeah. I mean, the answer is to ally with your kidnapper, right? Like she gets a hold of the radio and like makes contact with someone, and he's like, oh, it's Betty like playing tricks on us again. And it's like, this is the voice of a fucking young girl. Like, it just, it's so unbelievable. It's so just the fact that, you know, a security guard wouldn't, it's just, it like, it, it just feels so forced. And the fact that like Casey and the other girls are just forced into this fate, like just like pushed into it, and there's no other way they're getting out of there, is just, there's no, you know, all, every possibility just felt like a dead end in a way that like didn't feel genuine. It felt like it was set up to fail from the get-go.
Yeah, and you know, to your point, Robin, Ellie, about the movie's sort of muddled messages, like it's also, you know, juggling these themes of like, well, what do you do with your own personal trauma? And like, the movie doesn't have an answer on that. Like, I'm sympathetic as someone that has, you know, thought through, you know, how I've dealt mm-hmm. with, you know, things like my father passing and stuff like that, where I've had like major moments of trauma in my life. I agree with the notion that you can use moments of personal trauma to have a better understanding of yourself and come out the other side of that better understanding who you are and what you're capable of. I absolutely think that is something that came out the other end of losing my father. I'd rather my father was still around than having gone through that, but I understand the notion of one way of using and working through trauma is personal discovery. But like, that's not where this movie lands, and everyone deals with trauma different ways, and I'm not saying my way is the way, but like, the movie doesn't have a message on like what you do. One, it treats like trauma as only the most extreme version of it being like predatory child sexual abuse, and then doesn't run the scale there at all. Like, that's would have been an example for the other girls to have been able to, what is trauma? Like, what are the different layers of that? What are the different scales of that? And then also, how do you work through that? Because the movie ends with basically saying, I don't know, turn it into a superpower. And it's like, okay, like, better understanding my emotions because my dad died of a heart attack at 56 does not feel like a fucking superpower. Like, mm-hmm. I'm glad that I have a better understanding of myself, but like, it ain't a superpower. Mm-hmm. And that's like a hugely muddled part about this movie where I just like, okay, like, if you wanted to bring up trauma to convey a message of like positivity and understanding about how one can deal with trauma, like, this movie doesn't come out of that. It doesn't come out with a message on that. It's just like, it's, you're just left with
like, it almost endorses Kevin Beast's like fucked up worldview where, yeah, you know, I guess
should I just say fuck it? Whatever.
People who have gone through shit, that's when you become a fully realized person. The bad things that happen to you make you a real person. And other people...
And they're the only things that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and will give you power to inflict harm on other people. Like, it's not like he had some sort of self-realization and then, like, you know, Kevin comes out stronger. Or any of his alters that, you know, are functioning alters in society. Barry has like kept a job for 10 years and that's possible for, you know, people with DID, as one of the article states. But yeah, it's like being broken, being hurt, having past, you know, experiences of trauma are fuel to enact further harm, like on those who, on people around you. And like, that just, that does not land for me. Like, as someone who, you know, has experienced sexual assault, and as someone who's been through a relationship of abusive relationship, like, that is not like, that's not my story. Like, if you're gonna fucking tell a story of you know, overcoming, you know, like, survivorship, first of all, we don't fucking say victimhood anymore. We're like, we're not victims, we're like, we're the survivors. And like, I could have seen, and Casey, she is a survivor in the sense that she makes it to the end, and I fear that, you know, this movie did not give her like her credit for like everything that she's been through. And that was the most disappointing thing. And same for Kevin, because Kevin also, you know, and one of the articles talks about, you know, that this is like a method of protection, that like after repeated abuse, the psyche splits in an effort to protect itself. And that the idea of protection in the altar is that they are concerned about protection, is one that is present in real life and with people with DID. And I guess you sort of have like the two versions of protecting oneself after you know, going through trauma. And I'm just like not happy with the bad version, I guess. It just, there is a bad version that is about Kevin fighting for himself and you know, or the other alters fighting for themselves and, you know, fighting against the Horde or whatever. But even that, I don't know how to fucking make this a good movie. Like, straight up, I don't know how, like,
Not from him, right? Like, I don't think we've seen a lot of examples of him being able to, there's a lot of things that M. Night is good at, but playing with themes of sexual violence, sexual predator, like, you know, even just between Unbreakable and this movie, it's like, okay, dude, like, recognize this ain't it. For you, a lot of things you can make a movie about.
So the thing is, one, like, where I end up with Split is I feel like its whole attitude toward abuse and trauma and the effect that has on people is very much, man, he just made the subtext text. It is a very, like, hack screenwriter approach of, yeah, but wow, what experiences you have now. Wow, like, think about all the stuff, like, you can write what you know, and just imagine how much more depth and of feeling that you have compared to people who don't have these experiences. And that's where this movie ends up, and it's incredibly, like, schlocky and exploitative to kind of make that, like, the literal text of the film. But the other part of this is his movies borrow a lot of trappings from psychological thrillers because he is influenced so much by Hitchcock. But he actually, his tricks are fundamentally ones of, like, narrative elision. They're tricks that you've pulled off through editing, through other, you know, filmmaking techniques where you have allowed the audience to fall into a misunderstanding of what is actually happening in a film. This is his most successful films tend to follow these patterns, but they're fundamentally not about the inner life of his characters, because his characters are really just archetypes who are meant to go through this journey, and then the trick is sort of revealed at the end. He's a lot like Christopher Nolan in this way, in terms of he's using a lot of technical skill and paying a lot of homage to classic films to bring you with him on a journey and get away with a story that gives you the illusion of development and growth without having
humanity.
Without having characters capable of it. The problem that I really see in Split is that this is a movie it's his attempt to write a character-driven story, and he doesn't know what to do with it. And so we end up with this complete hash of messages and a movie that maybe ends up endorsing the predator's perspective on humanity, and also ends up endorsing this view that, like, you know, there's a right way to approach an experience where you're made a victim, and a wrong way. That's where this movie ends up, and I think this tends to stem from the fact that this is not the kind of story that Shyamalan is very good at telling. And he gives himself no out. There's no sort of, you know, surprise reveal of what's been actually happening in this film, except the fact it's a franchise. Everything else is basically there on the page. The characters coming to realizations is the characters having reactions, and those are bad. And they reveal really unhealthy and insensitive thinking about pretty much every topic this film considers.
What a fucking selfish twist. Like, the fact that the twist is, I'm going to make another movie about my, about my world.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you know, it's like, okay, go off, I guess. Like, I don't know.
I couldn't help but laugh that I didn't put this together at the time when I had seen Split, because I hadn't seen Unbreakable. So, like, I understood what was happening in the scene, you know, that connects everything, but it didn't land the same way because I just didn't have the personal connection to Unbreakable. But the fact that when we discussed Unbreakable last week and we were making fun of, like, the schlocky music that, like, comes in towards the end and, like, the final scene is the music that signals, like, when it says Split at the end, it comes in with that beat that is that schlocky music from Unbreakable, and that's the first sign, if, like, you're aware of the music to that film, that maybe there's something.
I also love the cops catch this guy, and they're immediately like, members of the media, we need to tell you that we're calling this guy the Horde, because he's yeah. fucking awesome. Those of us in the homicide department, we've never seen anything like this. He has so many personalities; they're all cool. They all just really fill the space. And so we are.
How do they land on the same name as the name that's already
he chose referenced? It.
Yeah, actually, I didn't think about that. That makes no fucking sense.
Yeah, officer, we're the Horde. Oh shit, that's awesome. Okay, cool. Do you prefer like a singular or plural pronouns?
Mr. Horde.
Yeah, like what's your? How would you like us to refer to you? Because we're going to make you famous.
Nonsense.
Apparently, Joaquin Phoenix was supposed to be the main character in this, and at the last second, James McAvoy became.
Wow.
The lead actor. Try to imagine this film with, Joaquin Phoenix, also a dude that knows how to chew scenery in a film. But man, what a different movie that would have been.
Yeah, totally.
Rob was so offended by that piece of trivia that he got up and left. He was like, nah, fuck this. He's got strong feelings on Joaquin Phoenix,
I guess.
Also, Sterling K. Brown was in this film and then just cut. Just
really?
Like, okay. Yeah, it says Sterling K. Brown played Professor Shaw, and although his part was completely cut from the film, his scenes appear on the DVD in the deleted scenes section. Sure. Why not? I want to shout out all of the pieces we have referenced. I did not do a great job of making sure we connected authors and ways people can check all those out. So there is... from The Verge, Split is the latest horror film to misunderstand why mental illness is terrifying by Charles Bromesco.
That's a great piece just about like how mental illness can be used in horror like effectively. That was like super informative for me in just like how I view that trope in general. So
yeah, it does.
Highly recommend.
It does. Yeah, you're totally right. Does a good job of showing like there are bad ways and good ways to use anything. Like it's often people say like, you shouldn't use, you know, sexual violence in horror films. Well, it's like people say that because you don't know how to fucking do it. You're doing it so bad. And so this movie, that article does a really great job of like, all right, take something that on its face, a lot of people would say, don't do it. And it's like, okay, if you were to do it, how do you find the humanity in that? And you know, that's something that the Split doesn't do. There's from The Nerdist, M. Night Shyamalan and Split cast on representation controversy by Christy Puchko. There is from The Mighty, watching Split as a person with dissociative identity disorder by Chris Alter. And let me pull up the last one.
Also on The Mighty.
Yes, also on The Mighty. What the movie Split got right and wrong by Tanya J. Peterson. Those are all like really good essays if you want some sort of critical analysis focusing on what ended up being sort of our main way of talking this way. This is a movie where it felt like it made more sense just to talk about it holistically than going beat by beat, because I think we would have just ended up coming back to all of this anyway. So that's going to do it for our discussion of Split. If you want to be here for the conclusion of our trilogy criticisms, so we're going to talk about Glass next. So that came out last weekend, so everyone will have 2 weekends. Even I think I'm going to be able to see it this Thursday. We'll have a chance to see it. So if you want to hear us do a spoiler discussion of Glass and sort of bring this trilogy to an end, make sure you check that out. Our thanks to Tumelo for our theme music. You can find out more about Tumelo and all of the good stuff that Tumelo is up to at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. It's the number 2. And follow him at mellowmakes on Twitter. You can keep up with all of us at waypointadvice.com. You can find me at Patrick Klubik. Natalie, where can people find you?
At Natalie Watson, waiting for this hellscape to be over.
Again, are you referencing Kingdom Hearts? Is the hellscape like no. one of? Is that the mobile game?
No, the hellscape is the Metro North trilogy. What's it called?
Oh, Acela Heroes.
Oh, right. Okay. And no, the Kingdom Hearts is a dreamscape. So just know that that's I'm true. In yeah, another world.
Okay, there
world.
You go. There you go. Rob, what about you?
At Rob Zachney.
If you are listening to this podcast, that means you are on the new feed.
Congrats.
We would appreciate Yeah, good job. You made it over. That's harder than it looks, you know? A lot of people just leave those podcasts behind. So please, if you could rate and review, tell other folks that this is on the new feed. We realize that takes some time for everyone to get up to speed. So any reviews, any ratings on whatever service you're using
No, only the good ones.
Yeah, only good ones. Maximum, minimum 3 stars. If you just think we're okay, that's I'll take a 3-star. But like, no 2 stars. Come on.
2s or 1s, just leave me alone.
Leave me alone. Right. All right. So we're gonna be back for Glass next week. We'll see y'all then.
How's it going? How's it going, Rob? It's going good. It's going pretty good. How's it going? How's it going, Austin?
This isn't a good bit, Natalie. I appreciate the hustle. I respect.
This is just for me. This is not.
It's not a bit. This is just pleasure.
Happens sometimes.
Gotcha.
Do you know that feel when you just want to sing your words instead of...
I was going to say extremely do not, but then I remembered a story from when I was... When did Newsies come out on Disney, the Disney Channel? Newsies.
A long time ago.
I saw Newsies... Well, that's not right. 1992, so I was 7. That's about right. And... I loved Newsies so much that when my friend Alex came to hang out, I wrote a note and put it up against my window so that he could read it. And it was like, we can't hang out today. My mom is sick. I have to take care of my mom. And also, even if we did hang out, we couldn't talk because all I do is sing now. I'm only singing for the rest of my life. I wrote this out on a piece of like ripped out notebook paper. And there was a drawing of me as a Newsie.
That's extremely
It was a
good.
Terrible drawing. I genuinely thought you were going to say the last time Christian Bale was any good. Christian Bale's in... I don't remember. I think he's the lead. I haven't seen this movie in probably 20 years.
Wow.
How are we doing? Oh.
What's up?
Tell Patrick to say something.
Patrick, say something.
Could you turn Pat down a little bit?
That's what I was wondering.
Thank you.
When I was in high school, it was like a thing. Like
Newsies.
No. Musicals. Singing.
Y'all should clap.
All right.
Like
clap.
when we would do stuff. No, we would just sing random words.
30?
Like,
well, hold on.
35.
I don't want to do my homework today. That was like an example of what we would do.
Very great.
We okay. all clappy.
Okay.
That's clappy.
I hate it. All right. I'm ready to
go. I got one.
Hey, it looks like you're about to record a podcast.
Okie doke. All right. Well, at 12, we'll take a break.
Take a break.
Austin bounce,
yeah.
And then we'll finish up with where we got. So, Austin, if there are things you want to get to that we don't get to before then, just make sure and give us a heads up so we can give you a last word before we
will do.
Get out.
Yep.
Last time I was in here, came in and took 3 chugs from that whiskey bottle and left.
Great. Good.
What? What kind of whiskey?
Dickies. Dickel.
Dickel?
Let's start this podcast. BRB.
I know a lot.
Who gets something
I've never
over
heard
there.
Of Dickel.
Yeah. It's good.
It's a bourbon, I think. It's
a Tennessee.
Not...
Sounds like a bourbon.
Yeah. Sour mash.
It could say sour mash. I can't read from here. I don't have my glasses on.
Tennessee whiskey or Tennessee sour mash?
Rob,
I think it's a sour mash.
I bought a 10-year whiskey from Trader Joe's for $23. They make their own whiskey?
Mmm.
Wow. Going from Kirkland to Trader Joe's?
Dickel is spelled differently than I thought.
How do you think? It was just a little dickel.
I put the L before the E.
Yeah.
Where do the dickels fit into the Kingdom Hearts lore?
It's a decal.
We've got to do this podcast.
Okay.
All right. I lost.
Three? Do you want me to count
I
you?
Lost,
you
no,
good?
I lost my document. I got it now.
Sorry about that. A random man walked in here and looked, and he had a hammer, and it was actually kind of scary. But he looked, he was like very old and scraggly.
We saw him come in.
Oh, okay. But he just had a hammer in his hand and like came in and just like looked around.
You talking shit about Split? I love that movie. M. Night's a genius.
God, that was my boyfriend.
Oh, no.
M. Night?
Nope. No.
Okay. We'll come
Let's
back
go.
In. All right.